So Jesus' words on the cross were, "Father, forgive them."
Oh, we have a few more.
So, let's start again then. Jesus' words on the cross were, "Father, forgive them." Forgiveness is the church's most powerful tool. Say that again. Forgiveness is the church's most powerful tool. In a world of justice and revenge, forgiveness is life-changing. The words that Jesus uttered on the cross, "Father, forgive them," are the words that changed the world. Jesus, the person who had been betrayed, is reaching out through the words and actions to an unrepentant people, offering forgiveness, reconciliation, and a new relationship. This is the injured party taking the first step to restore relations. So, who was Jesus forgiving? Well, the Jewish leaders, who hated Jesus because he threatened their position and status. The Romans, particularly Pilate, who was too weak and just wanted an easy life. The thieves next to him, one angry and joining in with the crowd, whereas the other realized who Jesus was and responded, asking for forgiveness. The Jews, who were hurling insults as he hung on the cross. Well, that's what mobs did when people were crucified. They hurled insults. And his disciples, who'd spent 3 years walking through Israel and Judea, who'd scattered, frightened, and not knowing what to do next. And then there's us. His actions on the cross covered all sin, whether previous, present, or future. So, what do those words mean for us today? How can we become more Christ-like through developing a forgiving nature? What impact would that have on our relations? Can acts of forgiveness transform Saltisford? I want to try and answer some of those questions through this sermon, and through the answers, understand how forgiveness works and why it is the most powerful tool in and for the church. Now, I had a friend at school called Dean, who I hadn't seen for 25 years, until a school reunion back in 1997. Now, Dean was a bit of a character. He left school at 16, married his 16-year-old pregnant girlfriend. That didn't go well. And then he moved to London, and I seen or heard nothing of him till the school reunion. A few years later, after the reunion, Dean linked up with me on Facebook. And then, totally out of the blue, I don't know where he got my phone number from, but he called me. I think it was about 2010, I'm not quite sure. And he asked me for my forgiveness for things that had happened back in the 60s and the 70s. Well, I couldn't really think of anything that needed my forgiveness. Now, I know we'd had a few fights. You do, don't you, at school? We'd fallen out over football, homework, girls. I remember one time he rode past me as I was walking along on his motorbike and kicked me. That hurt a bit, and he fell off his motorbike and broke his elbow. So, so he suffered more than I did. But I couldn't think of anything that I needed to forgive him for. But anyway, I said, "Yeah, Dean, I forgive you." So that was that. A year or so later, his posts on Facebook started talking about hospices. I was a bit perplexed. And then not long after that, he actually died, age 57. He wanted to put things right with me, and I guess with other people, before he died. Now, I don't know why that was. As far as I'm aware, he had no faith. So what actually drove him to ask for forgiveness? Now, another example. My mum and her sister fell out. They didn't speak for about a month. It was over a very serious matter. This was when I was a teenager and living at home. They'd fallen out over carpets. They'd both bought new hall carpets. And guess what? They were similar patterns and similar colours. And they accused each other of copying. So this went on for a month, and eventually my dad persuaded my mother to reluctantly say sorry and ask for forgiveness from her sister, and the relationship was restored. It'd been very sad for sisters who'd known each other and lived only a couple of miles apart, and this was in the days before either had a telephone. You know, we used to meet up probably once a week, certainly once a fortnight. To have a whole relationship destroyed over carpet colours and patterns, didn't it? But, you know, wars have been fought over lesser things. If those literary scholars among us will have probably heard of Gulliver's Travels, written by Jonathan Swift. That was a satire on 18th century politics. And in it, in the book, there was a war. The war was fought over which end of the egg to crack open when you had a soft-boiled egg. There was the big endians and the little endians, and they had a war over it. So carpets is probably quite serious in comparison to eggs. So forgiveness isn't easy, is it? My mother didn't want to forgive her sister. Dean, I guess, was driven by thoughts of his impending death. And this unnatural act, in both cases, was taken when something changed in their lives. Either my dad intervened or Dean was facing death. So if we look at a famous parable of Jesus, the prodigal son, which is in Luke chapter 15, verse 11 to 32, you don't need to look it up. The famine prompts the son into action. His money's all gone. He's living in a pigsty. He's not got any food. And therefore he decides to do something. And he goes back. However, the father is already looking for him and comes running. Now, men of status in the Middle East at that time didn't run. You know, they have to hitch up their whatevers and run. It wasn't quite dignified. However, the father forgave him. Now, would he have forgiven him if the son had gone away again and lived another reckless life and come back? What do you think? I think he probably would. And again? Yeah, and again? Probably. The son, in effect, by demanding his inheritance early, was implying that he wanted his father dead. And then he went and blew it all on reckless living. It's quite hard to forgive. There's the wasting of the money and the impact on the reputation of this obviously quite wealthy family. And then there's the brother, isn't there? He wasn't quite as forgiving as the father, to say the least. He was of the opinion that the forgiveness was unfair. Why should he get the fatted calf? I've been here all the time. There was injustice in that forgiveness. I guess the question for us, would we react like the father or actually like the brother? Think about that one. That's not an easy question to answer. I'm not going to ask you to answer it now. In another parable of the unrepentant servant, Jesus teaches that we need to forgive 77 times. That's in Matthew 18, verse 22. Implying it's not just once, but always. That's hard, but we all repeat our errors. I know I've repeatedly been insensitive and said the wrong things, causing hurt. At work, when mistakes are made, people often try and shift the blame. I'm sure you've all felt that at work at times. In recent years, I've tried to admit my mistakes, apologise, and then try and correct them where I could. It's an interesting way of demonstrating our faith, rather than blame shift, actually accept the responsibility when you've made a mistake. Sometimes forgiveness is needed as an immediate response to an incident. Now, back in December 2005, I took voluntary redundancy. Now, while I was working for Ford / Jaguar, I was entitled to two cars on the management scheme. Great, two cars. However, when I retired, I was only entitled to one. So I bought one of the other ones, which was a brand new silver Fiesta. Bought it on the 21st of December, collected it on the 21st of December. Now, Becky, our daughter's boyfriend, Paul, had been round the weekend before to tell us he wanted to marry her. So that was great, it was good news. So we said, yeah, of course you can, Paul. Then Becky asked us whether they could borrow a car to go to see Paul's parents over Christmas. So, as it was still on Ford's insurance till the end of December, that was fine. So, off he went. Paul's parents live in Matlock, Derbyshire. Now, we didn't quite have a white Christmas, but we had snow between Christmas and New Year. And you can probably guess what happened. Paul went out to collect one of his sisters and was involved in an accident. It wasn't his fault. The other car lost control in the snow, hit the Fiesta and pushed it into the stone wall. So it got hit on both sides. Nobody was hurt, which is good news, because people take more fixing than cars. So there was this brand new car with less than 1,000 miles on it that I'd just paid a lot of money for, smashed up. So my future son-in-law had to ring me up to explain what had happened. Could you imagine what he must have been going through? What a way to start a relationship, a long-term relationship. Now, I forgave him. You know, a car's a car, it's not that important. But when trying to think of personal examples to illustrate the sermon, I didn't actually recall this incident. Lynn reminded me of it. Now, that might be my poor memory or the fact that I'd forgotten the incident as well as forgiven it. I was no longer replaying the accident and building up bitterness and resentment towards Paul and thus spoiling our relationship. It's probably best to ask Lynn how I reacted when I put the phone down, because I'm not sure I remember. But I'm not sure it was probably very honouring to God. So, as I've already said, forgiveness is not a natural act. People want justice. You often hear that on the news, don't you? Want justice. Or revenge, or both. And if you look at the conflicts around the world, a lot of war is driven by wrongs sometimes committed long ago. If you think of the conflict between the British and the Irish, that goes back centuries upon centuries. English landlords misruling in Ireland, massacres by Cromwell in response to an uprising. Massacre by Cromwell, I think, was in about 1600 and something. But it's still remembered. And that reinforces everything. And the memories are still raw. And then they're reinforced by tradition. The whole parade season, the Orange Order, etc., is a reminder to the Irish of the conflict with the British, or between the British and the Irish, or the Protestants and the Catholics. And all it does is build further resentment and hatred. In his book, What's So Amazing About Grace, which we did in house school, that was very good preparation for this, John, thank you. Yancey talks about, if I can find it, a family that through four generations had what Yancey calls ungrace. Now, I'll try and recount it. It's probably better you read it in the book, but let's have a go. So, Yancey's talking about a woman called Daisy who was born in 1898, and when he was talking to her, she was nearly 100. So this goes back a long way. She was one of 10, she was the 8th, and things were relatively tight financially, as you could imagine. And then her father started drinking, so money got worse, and he was what she calls a mean drunk. So no doubt he hit and kicked the children. Then he threw her mum out, and she stayed at home with the others to look after her two younger children. Now, eventually, the whole family moved away, and the father disappeared as well. And then he reappeared, having turned up drunk one night in a Salvation Army hostel. He went forward at the altar call, because I had to go to the sermon, the service, in order to get a free meal. And he had an encounter with God, and he gave his life to God. And then he went and sought out his children to ask forgiveness for the way that he behaved. Daisy would not forgive him. She'd vowed never to speak to him again. In the last few years of her father's life, he lived 8 doors down on the same street, being nursed by one of his other children. She walked past that house virtually every day to go to the shops, yet she never called in to see him. She never spoke to him again. She had her own children, and in a different way, she ruled with a similar tyranny. And her children did not love her, and she didn't really love them. Now, Daisy's daughter Margaret, who is a Christian, who reads the Bible every day and prays and attends church, followed her mother's style of family life. And one of her 4 children rubbed her up the wrong way, and eventually they fell out when she caught him smoking pot in the 60s. So this, you know, you think about this, it's now 1960, it started in the early 1900s. She threw him out, vowing never to speak to him or see him again. Oh, doesn't that seem to be a repeat of what happened earlier? And that was 26 years ago when Yancey was recounting this story, and the mother still won't speak to him, despite Yancey's best efforts, because he knows all 4 in the family. 3 of the 4, because the father's dead. But he knows 3 of the 4, and he's tried to get them to meet and forgive each other, and they won't. What a tragedy. So, 4 generations of unforgiveness driving behaviour and wedges into individuals and societies. If you don't forgive, you replay the hurt over and over again, building bitterness and resentment. The wrong then damages you. And distorts and disfigures your life and the lives of those around you. Is that Christ-like? I don't think so. One way we as Christians can impact and change our immediate society, those people around us, is by developing a culture of forgiveness. Imagine some of the situations you've been in lately where you could have changed things by taking the first step and forgiving some person. It's one way of demonstrating Christ's love in action on a daily basis. We often wonder, don't we, how can we show Christ's love? Well, perhaps this is one way. One of Yancey's expressions is, the gospel of forgiveness stops the juggernaut of retribution. So again, the gospel of forgiveness stops the juggernaut of retribution. Now, here's the book. This is the old version. I think there's a prettier cover now. But it takes him 4 chapters to go through forgiveness. And he'll do it far more precisely in terms of language with longer explanations. So if you're interested, then have a look and read it. But it's all well and good looking at international politics and examples from books. But what about us here? Is it 19th of April, 10 past 7, in Saltisford? In a few minutes we're going to take bread and wine, which is a celebration and remembrance of what Jesus did on the cross when he spoke those words, "Father, forgive them." In Matthew chapter 5, verses 23 and 24, Jesus encourages us to be reconciled with our brothers, stroke sisters, friends, relatives, people at work. This instruction was given to those who were about to give a gift at the altar. So I guess the equivalent of taking communion in the Jewish tradition. So, in a few seconds I'm going to ask you just to take a little period of time in silence to reflect on your relationships and ask yourself the question, who do you need to forgive or ask forgiveness from? Is there some person in our church here at Saltisford that you need to do that with? And in this period of silence, you can think about that, pray about it. And I encourage you actually to do something about it, not just between you and God, which is great, but actually go and do something. So let's just spend a few moments thinking about that. Father, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I wonder how many times we've said those words. Do you believe that unless you forgive, then Jesus won't forgive you? That's hard, isn't it? The God of love expects you and me to show the grace to those that wrong us, betray us, hurt us, injure us, in the way that Jesus did for us when he was on the cross, when he uttered those words, "Father, forgive them." The forgiveness offered by Jesus is unmerited. We don't deserve it. It's unfair, as the prodigal son's brother points out. That's the forgiveness we should be giving. We should be wiping the slate clean, erasing the hurt. If we can add those characteristics to our lives and develop a culture of forgiving, then that could help transform the lives of those around us. Let us thank Jesus for the grace and forgiveness he poured out on the cross and poured into our lives as we celebrate communion together.